Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Practical Perspectives. Today we're going to review actual cases of biliary tract cancer. We're really thrilled to be working with Professor John Bridgewater from the UCL Cancer Institute in London. So as always, today we're going to be talking about some non-FDA approved uses of agents and regimens. Please consult the prescribing information for all these products for the approved indications. So today we're going to hear a bunch of real cases from practice from a number of community-based general medical oncologists. We've been doing this since the beginning of the pandemic. I think we've done more than 4,000 cases like this, and we really appreciate it when docs in practice are willing to go sort of public with their management of patients, looking for feedback. And we're looking forward to hearing about these cases today. Here's where we're heading today. We're going to start out talking a little bit about the biology of these cancers, epidemiology, guidelines, and then we'll drill down into management of localized disease, metastatic disease, first-line treatment, and then, of course, we're going to look at targeted treatment, HER2-positive disease, and the recent approval of the bispecific antibody zanidatamab. And we're going to talk a little bit about mixed hepatocellular biliary tract cancers, something that came up last week at the ASCO GI meeting. And we'll talk about FGFR fusions and a bunch of other cases as well. So, John, just to talk a little bit about some of the papers you've been involved with and also some of the more recent information about biliary tract cancer. This was a set of guidelines on the cholangiocarcinoma from the British Society of Gastroenterology. I'm curious how these guidelines compare to guidelines we use in the United States. Any significant differences?
Thank you, Neil. So UK and European guidelines in general are much more proscriptive than, say, the NCCN guidelines. NCCN guidelines, you know, quite permissive in terms of the use of several regimen for any particular situation, any particular clinical situation. To put something in a publication, we need much higher levels of evidence, and it would be, you know, difficult to support a looser approach in terms of prescription. So that's the primary difference. There is in fact almost an onus on the individual European countries to put a compound, to make a compound available if it's in a guideline. So these guidelines have some significant sway.
So we'll see as we go along through these cases, maybe you can refer back to this, but also curious what we've learned about the epidemiology. This is a paper you did for the ESMO GI meeting, looking at the incidence in various locations, a lot in Asia. When you visualize sort of the epidemiology of this disease, how do you conceptualize it?
So the epidemiology of gallbladder cancer is really primarily the epidemiology of gallstones, and this preponderance of gallbladder cancer in Asia really reflects the fact that there is relatively few people in Asia have gallbladders removed for cholecystectomy. There's this famous story of in South America where the sort of government programs for routine cholecystectomy were removed and the incidence of gallbladder cancer shot up. So it really is closely related to the epidemiology of gallstones. That's not a big surprise.
That is really fascinating. What about the biology of biliary tract cancers, and how does it vary based on the location, whether it's intrahepatic, extrahepatic, and particularly now, you know, we have this sort of running saying that biliary tract cancer is the new non-small cell lung cancer because so many targetable mutations seem to be coming out. Can you talk a little bit, you know, sort of globally, we'll get into a couple of the more common ones, but what we've learned about this?
It's really interesting growing area. It's not entirely a level playing field, so and it's all related to the cell of origin. So the intrahepatic tumors we think primarily arise in fact from hepatocytes, and with all the environmental and genomic pressures on hepatocytes, you develop a number of driver alterations, clear driver alterations in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, really that you don't see pretty much everywhere else. The famous one, of course, is FGFR2, which occurs in about 10%. That is a true driver alteration, and treatment for these patients is one of the big success stories that we've had in biliary tract cancer. It's different situation for the extrahepatic tumors where the etiology is much more inflammation, and you get much more in the way of RAS alterations and HER2 alterations. So really a slightly different spectrum. Nevertheless, with actionable alterations running, in my view, at around 1 in 3, it's really important to look for these and really important to act on these.
So I've got a couple cases here of localized biliary tract cancer, but first, this is a review article you did looking at adjuvant treatment. Can you kind of summarize where we are right now with adjuvant therapy, and what are some of the trials going on right now trying to move this forward?
Sure. So the situation with adjuvant therapy is fairly slow moving because, as you can imagine, it's quite difficult to run studies with these patients in this particular situation. Having said that, our study, the BILCAP study, has established capecitabine as the standard of care, which it still should be. The ACTICA study, that's probably going to report in 12, 18 months, that keeps moving around a bit, that number, will tell us whether adjuvant cisgem is better than capecitabine. There are a couple of other studies running at present, primarily an AstraZeneca study looking at a bispecific PD-L1 and TIGIT drug, which is incredibly promising. That's called the Artemide study, and I'd encourage everybody to look for that study for your patients.
All right, well, let's get into some cases here. And again, I'm so appreciative of docs being able, particularly tough cases, for example, this one here, common situations, but really difficult answers here. 61-year-old patient with an extrahepatic cholangio-T3N1 was discovered, and they went into surgery not suspecting it, discovered at surgery. Here's Dr. Giffey talking about what happened and her questions for you.
This is a totally healthy 61-year-old lady who had a routine cholecystectomy for intermittent right upper quadrant pain. Adenocarcinoma, cholangiocarcinoma, extrahepatic, grade 2, well to moderately differentiated. It was perforating all the way to the serosa, parentheses, visceral peritoneum, perineural invasion, and multiple positive margins. So she was staged as a T3N1, but clearly, with all the margins positive, we don't really know her surgical stage for this disease. The gallbladder couldn't even be anatomically oriented because it was received in a disrupted state. So she's very astute. I told her what a bad disease this is, how difficult this can be to treat. So she actually, on her own, went to a center of excellence for this and sought a second opinion from an academic who scanned her and thought that the area of soft tissue near the clips here could be soft tissue rind of disease left in the gallbladder fossa, suspicious for R1 disease. And so they recommended, per the TOPAZ-1 trial, the cisplatin, gemcitabine, and durvalumab. And she's just finishing up 4 cycles this week. And the plan is to take her for an actual oncologic surgery with nodal staging. She's tolerated cisplatin, gemcitabine, durvalumab pretty well. I like the regimen because the cisplatin is split dose, which is always tolerated better. She had very little nausea, but she did wind up with quite a bit of neutropenia. So I kept her at full dose and added G-CSF, and she's done very well. So my question about this case would be how much chemo immunotherapy you give in the adjuvant setting. Topaz 1, I believe, gave 8 total chemotherapy cycles, and then durvalumab until intolerance or progression. Is that how you would approach this case? And how do you, in general, approach cases where the cancer is found accidentally and you're kind of trying to clean up the mess afterward?
So thanks, any thoughts about this case?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, a little creative oncology here.
It's a difficult situation to have R1, almost R2, after your original somewhat unsatisfactory operation. I mean, the key to this is to try as much as possible to do another operation. What we would consider to be the first line treatment, platinum and immunotherapy is good treatment. It's not going to sterilize your tumor bed, I'm afraid probably is radiation. Surgery is the only thing that's going to do this. And so, if you can get, the key thing is to get your patient in sufficiently good shape to go ahead for a curative operation. The downsizing impact of the triplet, the doublet chemotherapy and immunotherapy is probably modest. So, we call it neoadjuvant, but I think I would say that's a somewhat flattering, concept of that. To be neoadjuvant, I would expect response rates of greater than 50%. And really, this combination, the response rate is 25% at best.
Any thoughts or comments about, in general, where systemic therapy would fit in, if at all, in how you manage patients, and whether or not you see any future for cell-free DNA and trying to assist either in situations like that or just straightforward adjuvant treatment?
At the moment, it's straightforward adjuvant treatment. After surgery, I mean, I would definitely suggest simple, straightforward adjuvant treatment with capecitabine. The role of cell-free DNA will come in, no question about it. In other situations, cell-free DNA is used to de-intensify treatment. Here, I reckon it would probably be a question of intensification of treatment. It will come in. It is going to be important. There's no question about it. It's just a question of getting the trials together to inform us.
So here's another case of a localized disease. This is a patient treated a couple years ago by Dr. Nathwani. A 64-year-old woman presented with abdominal pain, ended up going to surgery, had an intrahepatic cholangio and a liver met, which were both resected, both with positive margins. And as you'll hear, this patient, again, treated a couple years ago, got chemo radiation, but was also found to have an IDH1 mutation. Here's Dr. Nathwani with her questions about this case.
She's currently getting concurrent treatment with radiation and capecitabine. We also did biomarker testings, which did show this time the IDH1 mutation that was positive. And now that we have a targeted agent for that in this use, particularly in cholangiocarcinoma, ivosidenib, can we use this as like a therapy after completing concurrent chemo radiation was the question. I've never used any of these agents, so it was interesting that it's from AML and then straight to cholangiocarcinoma, and of course side effects. And I'm guessing there's no differentiation syndrome, but to prevent that, are we going to use steroids or what their experience is with this?
Really interesting situation. To be honest, in Europe, certainly there would be no rationale for radiation postoperatively in this situation. The efficacy of IDH1 drug, ivosidenib, was of course demonstrated in advanced disease and actually extremely advanced disease. So the efficacy of it was in effectively an adjuvant situation, as I think Dr. Nathwani is describing here, is unknown. It will be addressed in an upcoming adjuvant study that we're developing in Europe. But in fact, everything tells us that these targeted therapies will be more effective as adjuvant than they are in advanced disease. That's what the science tells us. And I mean, if you can get, I mean, we wouldn't be able to get hold of it. It's not licensed with this particular indication in Europe. But if you can get hold of it, there are virtually no side effects to evocidinib. It is unbelievably well tolerated. Well, in fact, when we did the original Clarity study, I had great difficulty in telling which patient was on placebo and which patient was on the drug. It's so toxicity wise, you wouldn't have an issue. If you can get hold of it, from the insurers or the reimbursers, I imagine that's going to be the biggest problem.
So, and I guess differentiate, you know, of course, we know about IDH mutations from acute myeloid leukemia, where differentiation syndrome is an issue, but I guess that's not an issue here.
That's a really good question. It probably is. It probably is one of the primary means of resistance to the IDH drugs. But the data on that are so slim, that I wouldn't go as far as to even mention it. Yeah.
So, and just out of curiosity right now, ideally, where would you like to use a drug like ivosidenib? Would you like to use it first line if you could? What about patients who are maybe not in the greatest shape to get chemotherapy with IO?
Yeah. So you go back to what ivosidenib did in the Clarity study. So in the Clarity study, a good outcome was stable disease. There were virtually no responders, and that fits in with the mode of action of the drug. It's a cytostatic drug. So I imagine that, and for instance, if you added ivosidenib to first line treatment, would you get that much of a pickup? Maybe not, based on the Clarity study. So the best place for it is probably maintenance treatment in holding disease stable in any patient, really, or in a patient who values quality of life. There are virtually no side effects. In fact, I don't remember submitting a treatment-related SAE for ivosidenib in any of the studies.
So a venue in the chat room has a patient, a 62-year-old woman with metastatic cholangiocarcinoma to the lung and peritoneum, treated with cisplatin, gemcitabine, durvalumab, and now progressing after 8 months. We were talking about mutations. NGS testing reveals an Aridia pathogenic variant, something I'm not sure I've heard about. Also, we'll get to this later, HER2 1+, but what about Aridia mutations? Any way to target that?
No, nothing worth its salt at the moment. Yeah, ARID1A mutations are actually quite common. No drugs for that just at the moment. But hold the space, because, you know, even as new drugs come along for new targets the whole time, and cholangio is such a target rich and indeed target responsive to cancer, it's the patient needs to hang on to that report and brandish it every time they meet an oncologist. Have you got a drug for me?
We're going to talk about first-line treatment in a second, but kind of getting back to this patient, what is your usual second-line therapy in a patient who's progressed on gem, cis, and an IO? And when do you start thinking about hospice and you're sort of giving up on therapy?
Yeah. The second-line treatment is dominated by any actionable alteration that you may have. If you don't have an actionable alteration, well, many people use what we described in the ABC6 study, which is FOLFOX. The Europeans use quite a lot of FOLFIRI. There's much less data for that, but it is undoubtedly has some kind of activity. And there's a Naleri study coming from the Far East that supports that. I sometimes offer patients regorafenib as well. So there's a phase 2 study supporting its value in that. It's a bit kinder than chemotherapy is, and in my view of similar efficacy. So those are the sorts of options which I would give a patient.
All right. Well, let's go. And we do have a case of first line. Of course, we talked about this all the time when the two trials that came out, and I think people are pretty familiar with it, but still a few questions. This is Dr. Warsh, who has a 55-year-old man, and like a lot of these patients, at least was not found to have an actionable mutation. Here's the case.
This is a 55-year-old male overall, healthy, presented to his primary care provider with findings of painless jaundice, which was pretty evident on exam. Lab showed total bilirubin of 17, sent to the emergency room. He underwent a CAT scan, which showed thickening of the intrahepatic biliary duct along with liver metastasis. He had an interventional radiology evaluation. Drain was placed percutaneously to improve the total bilirubin. Biopsy showed adenocarcinoma consistent with pancreaticobiliary primary. NGS testing negative. So given this stage 4 biliary carcinoma, no actionable mutations, the plan was to start him on the triplet of cisplatin, gemcitabine, and durvalumab. And the questions I had going through this case is, we think of generally when we're doing maybe neoadjuvant, adjuvant, curative, or more aggressive, perhaps with cisplatin, whereas we use carboplatin in stage 4. But in this patient, in this approval, it's really cisplatin along with gemcitabine and immunotherapy. And, we try to balance the morbidities of the treatment along with the benefit. Cisplatin was studied, and notably, as opposed to being a big dose on a day one, either 75 milligrams per meter squared or more. In the studies, it's day one and day eight of cisplatin, 25 milligrams per meter squared. And it's a little bit of an unconventional protocol compared to maybe some other regimens that we're used to. So I guess the question is, what do we feel as far as comfort level of this schedule compared to just on day one? And I know sometimes we do the split dose cisplatin for bladder cancer. And there's a TOPAZ-1 trial with durvalumab, KEYNOTE-966 with pembrolizumab. So is there a consensus, is one agent, one trial more efficacious, superior compared to the other trial?
Once again, excellent questions. And I'll answer it in two bits. I probably don't do it justice, but I will answer that in two bits. The use of split low-dose cisplatin and gemcitabine came originally from the ABC2 study, which we published 2010. And that was for two primary reasons. The first was at that stage, the perceived frailty, really, of biliary tract cancer patients. It turns out not to be the case, but at that time, we thought that all our patients were going to be elderly and frail with poor renal function. And so it was a more gentle regimen. And we just crossed our fingers and hoped our patients would get through the study. As it happened, it turns out that probably, there's an argument that the low dose of cisplatin is simply a sensitizer for gemcitabine. The gemcitabine works better consequent on the cisplatin. There's quite a lot of data to support that. I guess that's all historical, but it is a regimen that's well tolerated and is the background to the immunotherapy additions. Is there a difference between the immunotherapies? I don't think there is. There are two key aspects to the addition of durvalumab and pembro to the chemotherapy backbone. Firstly, you got to manage your patient's expectations with that. It's incredibly valuable in a relatively small number of patients. You've got to use it. It has modest toxicity, but patients do get their hopes up when they receive immunotherapy, and it's not necessarily entirely borne out. So the management of expectations is a key aspect of that.
So I'm going to move on now and get into something that's very new, and we're getting a lot of questions about it. When any time a new drug comes into practice, the general oncologist is scrambling around to try to figure out where it fits in, what the toxicity profile. And again, we just saw this exciting approval of the bispecific zanidatamab, and we have two cases relevant to it. Actually, the first one is a patient who has HER2-positive disease, just presenting now. The other patient actually has HER2-low disease, IHC2+, but Dr. Mulheron, who's a really well-versed general medical oncologist, he was actually at the ASCO presentation of zanidatamab. I think there was also one on TDXD that he saw at that time. And so it was interesting. He had some thoughts and questions about it. So here are the two docs.
This is a 74-year-old woman. She underwent a cholecystectomy for cholecystitis. There was no suspicion at the time that there was malignancy, but was noted on pathology to have carcinoma in the gallbladder consistent with biliary tract origin. Her HER2 expression was 3+ by IHC, and NGS showed a HER2 amplification as well. She had imaging for complete staging, which was notable for 3 sites of peritoneal metastases. So given her HER2 biomarker, when would be the best line of therapy to use HER2 targeting therapy? And when it is being used, what agent or regimen would be best in terms of targeting HER2?
Any questions about your 67-year-old man with metastatic gallbladder cancer?
Let's say he had IHC 3+, not just 2. If he progressed on frontline pembro chemo, now, well, you've got 2 drugs. We have this recent approval of zanidatamab, but we also have TDXD. There are more patients in the zanidatamab trial than there were in the BTC subset of DESTINY-PanTumor02. How do you select between those? Mechanistically, what's the difference there? What are the toxicity profile? How are those different? And another related question, progress on Zani, could you use TDXD or vice versa? Is there an advantage to being an ADC versus the bispecific? Everyone is, I think, pretty familiar with TDXD if you treat and then solid tumor oncology now, but hardly anyone's used zanidatamab unless you happen to be involved in one of these trials. I think many people are going to go with, in the community, are going to go with what's familiar. So if you want to use Zani, you have to give a reason for, okay, so you don't know ILD, you know, no, you don't worry, have to worry about the nausea. You don't need 4 and 5 drug regimens to prevent nausea. I mean, I think there is a toxicity reason to favor using this in this subset. It's just not as many people know about it. I saw a patient earlier today, is now a BTC, he has esophageal cancer, yet a HER2 mutation. What does that mean? You don't have a tumor agnostic approval for TDXD for there.
So we've got a bunch of slides in the slide deck on the trials. We'll maybe take a look at them, but what we really want to hear from you is your experience, particularly with zanidatamab. Yeah. You know, everybody's asking the question, how well is it tolerated? It's a bispecific, very few bispecifics like that in oncology. There's one, an EGFR amivantanab, that has a lot of toxicity. We're starting to see these interesting bispecifics. This one targeting 2 parts of the HER2 antigen. So can you talk a little bit, particularly in terms of your clinical experience with this agent?
Yeah, thank you. So I just need to do justice to your speakers here. Dr. Lorber asked, when would be a good time to introduce HER2-directed therapy? So that, once again, an excellent question. Generally speaking, we would aim to do that in second line in following failure of first line chemotherapy and immunotherapy. There are a couple of studies, first line studies out there using the 2 usual suspects, zanidatamab and TDXD. So in some ways, maybe a perfect option would be to go for, to try and get your patient onto one of those phase 3 studies. The question of Zani versus TDXD. Well, what an interesting question. They are both incredibly effective drugs. We know this. There will never be a head-to-head. Curiously, my personal experience is much more with zanidatamab. TDXD is pretty much reserved for for some types of breast cancer in Europe, and I personally have only used it in esophageal cancer studies. There's been no approval as such. The big difference between them is the toxicity and the lung disease from TDXD. I'm deeply saddened, in fact, by the death of one of my patients on TDXD from lung disease, in fact, with esophageal cancer. That sort of marked me, really. This does not happen with Zani. Indeed, the worst thing that you might get with Zani is a very modest amount of diarrhea. Otherwise, it is incredibly well tolerated and extremely effective. I've been able to access Zani through the compassionate use program because I was part of the original phase two biliary tract study, and they permitted compassionate use, and I've treated about 30 patients with it, and it has to be said, it's an extremely effective drug. Patients fade. You know, performance status 2-3 patients go back to work. They call it the wonder drug.
Sounds exciting. Let's take a look at some of the data. First, the issue of how often you see IHC expression. It looks like you see quite a bit in cholangiocarcinoma. It's almost comparable to breast. You know, IHC 3 plus, almost a third of patients, and a bunch of others having HER2 low. Of course, we have in the United States a pan-tumor approval for IHC 3+. Any comments, though, about, again, the epidemiology of HER2-positive biliary tract cancer?
So it's primarily in the gallbladder patients, although you can, of course, get it in the other biliary tract subtypes. Peculiarity, if you like, of HER2 expression in biliary tract is that it's the only thing that survives another dominant driver. So, for instance, most of the drivers in biliary tract cancer are almost completely mutually exclusive with other drivers. You get, if you have a RAS, you have nothing else. If you have an FGFR2, you have nothing else. HER2 is the only thing that actually goes between the various subtypes and in the context of other drivers. So ordinarily, if I had a patient with RAS, I'd say, oh, well, forget it. Don't bother doing any more tests except the HER2 immunohistochemistry.
Interesting. What about the question? You know, it's interesting, Dr. Lorber's case was a gallbladder cancer, but yep. Dr. Mulhern, the patient had IHC 2+. You know, in breast cancer, we would reflexly look at the amplification, FISH or NGS, and if it was amplified, treat the patients HER2 positive. It's interesting when you kind of get beyond breast cancer, I don't see as much discussion, as much consideration of amplification in the trials. Like if you had a patient who was IHC 2+ and it was FISH amplified, would you want to use anti-HER therapy? Would you want to use zanidatamab? I don't know if you can or not.
At the moment we can't. It's just for the 3+.
Right.
But I think this opens up a can of worms about how you test for HER2 overexpression. Is it just immunohistochemistry? How important is copy number? How good is the NGS, liquid or tissue? I think that whole question there. And indeed, if you do use immunohistochemistry, what parameters do you use? Do you use the gastric parameters? Do you use the breast parameters? Most pathologists give me a slightly different answer whenever I ask them. So there's a fair amount of uncertainty about the best test. I think that's the way to put it. So the question is not so much what's the best drug, but what's the best test and what's the most reliable test.
What about Dr. Mulhern's question? He had this other patient who had HER2 mutant disease. We know non-small cell lung cancer, that's pretty common. T-DXd is approved and used commonly. Some docs use it first line. What do we know about HER2 mutant disease and anti-HER therapy in biliary tract cancers?
In biliary tract cancers, we know very little. So in our current first line study, so if you just take a step back, there are two answers really. Firstly, what works, and secondly, what you should use if you were looking at the molecular biology. What works is T-DXd. T-DXd works in the lung mutants and potentially is the only other effective drug here. What you should use is probably a small molecule with trastuzumab is what the science tells us. That is in fact what we're using for the HER2 mutations in our current maintenance study, the ABC-10 study.
Interesting. So as I mentioned, we just saw relatively recently, the end of November, the approval in the United States of zanidatamab and people scrambling around. We saw some really interesting data from the phase 2B Horizon BTC1 study at the ASCO meeting. But can you talk a little bit about what this agent actually is and how it works?
Yeah. So another way of asking that question is, why is it so much better than trastuzumab, which on paper would seem to be a very similar thing? And it's really well designed. It targets two different epitopes on HER2. So instead of targeting HER2 as a whole, and consequently, you have this. The diagram actually doesn't do it terribly, doesn't do it justice. But essentially you get multiple dimerizations and more than dimerizations of HER2 receptors, clumping, if you like, of multiple HER2 receptors on the cell surface. And this holds together, much more than trastuzumab alone. That's what the zanidatamab people have been telling me for years. So I repeat it. I don't know whether that's why it works so much better. The fact is it does.
We have a lot of situations where we have things that we can see work, but we're not exactly sure why. Any comments on what was seen in terms of efficacy here, in terms of response rate, duration of response, survival? Any comments?
I think this, if anything, somewhat underestimates the benefit of zanidatamab. I think this was used in multiply pre-treated patients. It's a standard phase 2 study. Patients had a whole load of stuff before they got this far. So if you used it in, for instance, a strictly second line population or even a first line population, I imagine the impact would be better. Having said that, I have had experience of a couple of patients in which it simply does not work. And there's nothing really that I thought would have told me who those particular patients were. I now have an expectation that this stuff does work and works well and adds really good quality survival. But at the same time, there are some patients in which it clearly doesn't work and we haven't worked out how to tell those patients.
So, and the waterfall plot looks pretty encouraging. We talked already about the safety, and it's always tough. You know, you look at the data here, but it's a lot more effective to talk to somebody who's actually used it. And I think what you said really describes a very interesting safety profile. This was just presented last week at the GI symposium, looking at the optimal dose. It looks like the dose that's being used is being used for a good reason. Any comment on that?
I think the current dose is the correct dose. It's incredibly well tolerated. There are virtually no, a little bit of diarrhea, but otherwise extremely well tolerated.
Any comment about new trials in HER2 positive disease? At the top, you see the Horizon BTC 302 study. looking at zanidatamab plus standard of care versus standard of care, I guess a similar trial looking at T-DXd. What are you expecting the Horizon trial to show?
So that's really interesting what to expect from it. How much more is HER2 targeting going to add to your systemic chemotherapy? I think it'll add really quite significantly. I mean, somewhat dull logistical thing, but actually one of the huge advantages of having a HER2 targeted drug is that your immunohistochemistry will take a few days to do at the most. So actually shortly after you've seen your patient, you have the result and you can then sort of prescribe your treatment appropriately. Other tests, even with the best will in the world, other driver alterations, it takes a bit longer to come back. And so really, the short turnaround time for immunohistochemistry is hugely to its advantage.
So we saw some data looking at zanidatamab in HER2 positive colorectal cancer. Mm. Any thoughts about where this agent's going to fit in beyond biliary tract, including breast cancer?
Yeah. So there's really no reason why Zani shouldn't become a tumor agnostic drug. It should be as effective for all other HER2 positive. Indeed, in the phase one Zani trial, we used it for a number of people, non-biliary patients, and it was extremely effective. And originally the compassionate use program, expanded to any HER2 patient. And I had some experience with that. I think the issue about, I mean, I have really very little doubt that at some stage it will become a HER2 agnostic therapy, like T-DXd effectively. The rub, of course, is that it's not the quality of the drug; it's the type of cancer that then impacts on how effective your drug is.
Interesting. So we're going to move on now. Actually, in the chat room, Hassan says he has a 60-year-old man with a large mass. It was Mayer who had a question. Actually, the same thing Dr. Mulheron said, because Hassan's case we already talked about, it's a similar case. Do you have any experience with T-DXd post-Zani or vice versa? This was brought up by Dr. Mulheron.
Yeah. So, both the T-DXd and Zani studies, had a proportion of patients on there who'd had other previous HER2 therapy, including Zani and T-DXd. So, and there was a modest benefit. So, there clearly is a differential mechanism of these agents. They work differently, and there's clearly they clearly work in some HER2 patients. Zani works in some, T-DXd works in some. They clearly have different optimum activity populations. That's going to be quite a complicated thing to work out who to give Zani to and who to give T-DXd to. I think that's another 3-hour conversation that we might have at some time.
Although if you focus on the toxicity, it gets a lot more straightforward. Here's the case from the chat room. It's interesting that this case was put in there because just popped up just as we were about to talk about the same topic. 6-year-old man with a large mass in the liver, alpha fetal protein 2000, but the biopsy consistent with cholangio. So ? How to proceed? And that was actually a topic that we talked about last week. We did a symposium actually on HCC. And one of the things I did was I interviewed a number of investigators prior to that meeting. We showed video clips and asked the faculty to respond. And one of the issues, this is actually brought up by Dr. Abrams, was this issue of cases like we just heard from the chat room of mixed HCC and BTC tumors. here's the conversation. I wanted to hear what happened last week at ASCO GI and see what you think about it. Here's what happened.
If you have a patient with discordant tumor markers, say a very high CA19-9 and a normal AFP, but the radiographic criteria are very consistent with HCC, what would you do in that situation? The American Society of Liver Diseases is okay with just going by radiographic criteria, but they could have an element of cholangiocarcinoma, and without a biopsy, you're not going to know that. We see mixed tumors, you know, not frequently, and clearly the treatments are so radically different. In general, what I do when I see them is I treat it as a cholangiocarcinoma first because, you know, these days you have chemo plus immunotherapy. So ideally, it seems like you're kind of covering both by treating it with GemCis durvalumab or GemCis pembrolizumab. There's no great way to do it. It's difficult. And if something's not working, you may flip the script and go to an HCC regimen afterward.
So I think this is super common in clinical practice, at least for me. What are your thoughts, Dr. El-Khoueiry?
Generally, I would follow the same approach for these mixed tumors. Is start with the GemCis plus IO, thinking I'm covering both. But I like the comment that you kind of adjust as you go. Recently, I just saw a patient actually who's had regimens treating both and only responded to the HCC regimens and not to the chemo.
Dr. Finn?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, giving a patient the diagnosis of cholangiocarcinoma isn't doing them a big favor, right. You know, especially if they don't have a molecular marker, right? I mean, nowadays, the prognosis for HCC, stage for stage, is better. I'm pretty sure Len Pembro has an NCCN listing for cholangiocarcinoma, you know, low-level evidence, and that might be something to consider, right? If they progressed on GemCis Pembro, then you do a Tezobev, and they're progressing, you know, Len Pembro might be something to consider.
Dr. He.
In those cases, I do try the durvalumab GemCis, and as one of the lines of therapy, and try it out, and sometimes it works. The problem is people with cirrhosis, and they tend not to tolerate chemo for long. So right. You can only try it for a short course.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's difficult to disagree with much of that. I mean, I just sort of take a step back, take it back to the cell of origin thing I was just talking about earlier. The intrahepatic cholangio and the HCC arise from the same cell of origin. So you could add, and indeed, the etiology of both of these cancers is incredibly similar. So you could say that that actually it's quite reasonable to have one bit of your cancer spinning off as an intrahepatic cholangio and the other bit spinning off as an HCC. And you know, you are almost, and you are effectively treating two different cancers. Indeed, some of these diagnoses, parts of it could be HCC, parts of it could be cholangiocarcinoma. You're effectively making up on there. I would, however, just emphasize it is critical, even if you think it's probably HCC, it's absolutely critical to do your NGS and to see whether there are actionable alterations, because that might take you in a completely different path.
So speaking of alterations and treatable alterations, so we actually have a case from Dr. Warsh of a patient with an FGFR2 fusion. Here's the case and his questions about it.
This is a 78-year-old man, presents with abdominal pain, elevated LFTs, elevated total bilirubin. The CAT scan shows liver metastasis, no primary site of disease. We did a biopsy, which reveals adenocarcinoma, staining positive for CK7, but negative for the other markers we stained for. I sent off a blood testing for an NGS panel, and on the blood, we found this FGFR2 WRN fusion. After having this result back, I felt pretty confident that this was a biliary carcinoma. And the problem with this gentleman was that, you know, he was elderly, maybe not in the best of shape, had poor liver function. Knowing he has this FGR fusion, and there's two medicines that are directed towards this fusion that are approved in futibatinib, along with pemigatinib. And these are both, unfortunately, though, approved in second line. So the question I would have is, if you have someone who has this mutation, you don't think they're a candidate for doublet chemotherapy, would you ever consider using this earlier on first line therapy as opposed to waiting for second line? This is a pretty newly approved drug, and I honestly don't have a ton of experience just because it's not the most common disease. So I would ask the experts who have managed this a little more often, what side effects do we look for and what do we think of other pre-testing labs and what sort of monitoring do we pursue for these medicines?
So any thoughts? You know, we have two approved agents. Is there any difference? Which ones do you prefer? And a lot of questions about tolerability.
Yeah. Targeting these true drivers has been a real breakthrough for these cancers. And I tell my patients in whom I find a fusion that you know, instantly that adds 2 years to their life. And that always goes down really remarkably well. Would I use it in first line? Absolutely, definitely used in first line. Quite a few, in fact, the earlier phase studies, the phase two studies, both in PEMI and in some of the newer drugs subsequent to futibatinib, have cohorts, have chemotherapy-free cohorts in them, patients, you know, in whom you'd give the FGFR2 inhibitor first, and there are other first line studies. So I think it's totally reasonable to use in first line. It's incredibly well tolerated. Both of those drugs, not the ones coming out in study now, but both of those drugs, you get hyperphosphatemia. That's relatively easy to control. If they stay on it long enough, they lose their fingernails, but really that's about it. And I have patients on these drugs. I think I have a patient from the original phase one futibatinib study who's still alive on treatment at 6 years. So, you know, these are really, really, really good medicines and, you know, have transformed the lives of these patients. I mean, if I've got a moment, I would just add the testing to find a fusion is really important. Some tests are better than others. And I just emphasize to all my colleagues and my patients, it is absolutely critical to get the best test you can to see if you have a fusion, because you simply cannot afford to miss it.
We hear a lot about RNA in fusions and RNA assays. Is that sort of on your menu?
Yeah, absolutely. So you must get RNA sequencing as opposed to DNA sequencing. A lot of the commercial tests that are available just use DNA sequencing, which will miss something in the region of 25-30% of your fusions. You can't afford to do that. It makes such a big difference to find these.
So I want to talk about a couple of papers and new agents in biliary tract cancer that you've been studying. I was very interested in this. Is a trial in progress, an adjuvant trial. I'm not sure how easy it is to pronounce, rivlagostimib. But what is this agent and what's your experience with it?
So our experience is primarily in this study, which is a really good adjuvant study. It randomizes patients between standard of care, be it some people on the planet use cisplatin gemcitabine as adjuvant to standard, but standard of care versus this stuff, rilvegostomig, which is a bispecific PD-1 TIGIT, and both the biology and the sort of relatively modest numbers in the phase two studies suggest that this is way more effective than PD-1 alone, and so this is really very, very promising. The other bit of information that circumstantial, if you like, is that the immune environment in the adjuvant setting is much more friendly to PD-L1 and PD-1 and TIGIT inhibition than in the advanced disease setting. So really, you know, this could be really a very effective treatment.
So anytime I see a paper that has the word microbiome, for some reason, I always find it interesting. And I see this is a paper you are involved with, a trial in progress, actually looking at patients who get the first-line durvalumab cis-gem regimen. What are you going to look at here? And what do you know about the microbiome in general in biliary tract cancer?
So we don't know a great deal about the microbiome. Hence, this is an extremely exploratory study looking at the microbiome at the beginning of treatment and at 18 weeks. And it looks at how it's changed, and it looks at there are various efficacy measures for how sort of immune friendly, if you like, your microbiome is and what difference that makes. And so, we effectively know nothing about the microbiome in biliary tract cancer. And this will hopefully, educate us as to how important it is. It is probably quite important, but exactly how important, who knows?
So I'm going to finish out with this case, a 66-year-old man. You know, we've talked about, you know, cis, gem, and IO, but often we see patients like this one who have performance status that's very poor and maybe not eligible for that type of intensive therapy. Here's the case. How about this 66-year-old man?
So this gentleman was diagnosed with a metastatic cholangiocarcinoma, multiple lesions in the liver, some in the lungs, and his molecular testing showed KRAS G12A and a PIK3CA mutation. Initially, he had a very poor performance status, presented to clinic afterwards in a wheelchair, and he has limited social support. So I opted just to use gemcitabine as monotherapy. He's done fairly well with it, and his performance status has improved. His imaging, though, looks fairly stable. So my question for this patient with cholangiocarcinoma is, with these mutations, is there anything that you would try to use in a targeted fashion to improve his response, or would you plan to just add in a platinum or switch to like a FOLFOX regimen?
So your approach to this type of patient, and any thoughts about these mutations, KRAS G12A, PIK3, of course, we hear a lot about that in breast cancer, and we talked before about Iridia.
Yeah. So, quite frankly, I think you've done rather well with that patient. Jeb, if you maintain that patient in some form of quality of life for a while, I think you've done it incredibly well. The bad guy there, of course, is the RAS G12A, and until the pan RAS drugs come into common practice, there's probably not a lot else you can use. I would argue that the rationale for using FOLFOX in these patients is pretty small. FOLFOX is toxic treatment, and I'm not sure that this patient would tolerate it that well. I reckon you've done very well already.
All right. Well, John, thanks so much for working with us tonight. We learned a lot really interesting about zanidatamab. I'm excited to hear patients are going to receive that. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, John.
Bye.